The greatest development in the last 200 years has nothing to do with technology. It's lifespan. In the year 1800, lifespan was 37. In the year 2000, the numbers flipped. It was 74. Graduates of universities today will likely live into their 90s. Life is short, but it's also long.
So welcome back. We are excited for today's episode. How you doing today, Logan?
I'm doing pretty great. Adam, how are you?
You're just back from spring break. How was spring break?
Spring break was interesting because it was my last spring break as a student, really, unless I decided to go to grad school.
Trust me, it's not your last spring break. You will get, if you have kids, you get lots of spring breaks. They are just different.
They're just
See, one is restful, one is full of anyone can fill in the blank.
Okay.
Yes. So
Adam speaks from experience that I don't have, so I appreciate this knowledge that you're bestowing on me.
Wisdom. Wisdom.
Yes. Some might call it that.
So it's the reason we bring that up is we want to talk about rest. We want to talk about rest today, and
I think it's important.
It's interesting because we talk about rest a lot of times, and we'll get some rabbi in here, right? Because
we're gonna get double rabbi.
We're gonna get double rabbi.
It's gonna be rabbi squared.
Rabbi squared. It's like double mint gum, right? It's like the rabbi twins. So with Shabbat or Sabbath, that's one of the things we talk about when we talk about rest. And it's interesting because the day of rest is typically referred to as the Sabbath. But what's interesting is Sabbath comes from a Hebrew word, and that Hebrew word is Shabbat. But Shabbat does not mean what we think of rest. Lay on the couch, watch TV, maybe read a book. Rest or Shabbat actually means strike from work. And there is a striking difference between strike from work and reactively or not, what's the opposite of proactive?
Reactive.
Ooh, reactive is a good one. Reactive is a good one. So reactive rest, where you're just sitting there watching TV, not really engaging in anything, versus strike from work, which is proactive, and you are actually forced in this type of rest to actively pursue the alternative of what you consistently do. And as Logan mentioned, we have another rabbi. We're rabbi squared today.
It's pretty great.
Rabbi interview a rabbi. And I think Logan was just shocked and dumbfounded by the conversation that was going on throughout the experience.
Well, you know, you think about a rabbi giving a sermon, and when a rabbi interviews another rabbi, it's like a sermon answered with another sermon.
Yes, this is the longest episode of the podcast.
It's 4.5 hours.
Give or take a few. Yes.
Minutes, yes.
Yes. maybe seconds. This is one of my dear friends, colleagues, but most importantly, a mentor, Rabbi Micah Greenstein. I was fortunate enough to be an assistant and an associate rabbi under him at Temple Israel in Memphis, Tennessee. And he provides some very unique perspective on what true rest means, and more importantly, how we can really integrate through quality health our mind, body, and soul.
So let's take it away with this episode of the Four Questions Podcast with Rabbi Micah Greenstein.
Tell us about your journey to becoming a rabbi.
So, as most college students, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I was pre-med, pre-law, pre-life. after dropping second semester of organic chemistry before I received my grade, I finally ended up in economics. And my economics advisor recommended that I go to the Kennedy School because I had a passion for public service. And I just switched from public policy to and public service to Jewish service and realized that meaning making would be my destiny, and trying to help others find meaning in their life, whatever their unique gifts are. So I went to rabbinical school after the Kennedy School, after Cornell University.
So here you are, you're now in Memphis, Tennessee. You've been there for how long?
Nearly three decades.
So as you think about where you are now, three decades later, what are you most passionate about now?
What am I most passionate about?
Yeah.
Helping people see the uniqueness of everyone they encounter. Whether we call it the image of God in another human being, or to help not just look beyond the surface, but to see that we're really not bodies with souls. We're really unique beings, unique lights, unique souls with anatomy. So my passion is to help people understand through my lens of one God means one humanity, that we're all really different refractions of the same light, you might say, and yet we're all different lights.
Yeah, absolutely. So how does that passion translate or manifest in your daily work?
Well, it infuses everything I do. I would say, take for instance, all the events that are going on in the world. Take the word sanctuary. Take the word for immigration or refugee, for instance. Beyond the political dimension to that, which I'm not interested in, most people, when you think about sanctuary or houses of worship, it's about coming to a place where people look like me. It's a sanctuary for people of my tribe, right? Judaism is simply my particular language for realizing this universal idea that to be a human being, to be, whether you're Jewish or agnostic or atheist or Christian, is to realize that we're here in this world because we're essentially the same. We just speak different languages, different roads to the same destination. So how does it manifest in my work? Two nights ago at Crosstown Concourse in Memphis, www.crosstownconcourse.com. It is an ideal global village. We had a night with people in the neighborhood who... We have a global cafe here that serves Syrian food, Sudanese food, and Nepalese cuisine. And the cooks live in the neighborhood. So we basically had them tell their story. And it was amazing. It was probably the first time many people there met a 24-year-old Syrian who was tortured for 71 days and somehow ended up in Memphis, Tennessee. So it infuses everything I do. That's why I'm in Memphis. Memphis is the Jerusalem of civil rights. It's a city not just with a soul, but that lives that idea that one person can make a difference to inspire others to see that one light in all of us.
So in thinking about your growth personally, professionally, if you could go back, whether it be college or your early 20s, mid-20s, what's one advice or what's one thing you would tell yourself or that you wish you heard that you had to learn much later?
I would say listen to your own heart and your internal barometer rather than looking for the external answer to finding meaning and balance in your life. I think only you know what's going on inside you. So, for instance, if you're on the treadmill trying to achieve and then you get a big job somewhere and you're fried from working a 90-hour week, if you're really listening to yourself, then you need to renew yourself and decompress. You need to be honest with yourself. You need to, if you're feeling empty inside, but you're rocking it academically or professionally, then it's your soul that needs feeding. It needs a tune-up. So I think it's only natural when you're in your 20s. My whole take on this is the greatest development in the last 200 years has nothing to do with technology. It's lifespan. In the year 1800, lifespan was 37. In the year 1900, it was 47. In the year 2000, the numbers flipped. It was 74. Now we're trending beyond 80. Graduates of universities today most will likely live into their 90s. So if you do the math and you divide life into 4 years of high school or college, and let's say you live to 92, which will not be unusual at all for people in their 20s, you haven't finished your freshman year of life until you're 24 years old. You haven't finished your sophomore year until you're 48. That's about just being halfway done with your life. And these universities were mostly established in the 1800s. I was at Cornell and Harvard. That was in the 1700s. Cornell was in the 1800s. And if you were 22 or 21 coming out of school and you only lived to 36, 37, you were more than halfway done with your life. So I guess I wish I had known when I was younger that lens, that perspective. It's very hard to see it when you're in the fishbowl of academia or university, or you're a senior. What are you going to do with your life? Life is short, but it's also long.
So how do you find inspiration daily?
Besides looking at the picture of me that sits on your office desk.
Yeah, I just turned it around, actually. I take health seriously, not just physical health, but mind, body, soul. And the word inspiration, you know, comes from the word for breathing life into yourself. So I pray, I run, I try to reflect. You know, the buzzword's mindfulness, but I try to slow my roll. I do the 5-1-7 thing, you know that? You inhale for five, you take a second, and then you exhale seven. All those techniques. But mainly for inspiration, I like to study. I think what grows never grows old. I like to read. And the bottom line, I would say, is family. I believe that it all comes down to family, faith, and finding your unique passion. That's how I find inspiration.
So if you were thinking about what, we talked a little bit about kind of what wakes you up in the morning, your passion a little bit, and what inspires you. What's one thing that keeps you up at night?
Well, in my own work as a rabbi in the Deep South, I would say maintaining a culture of excellence. Because, as you know from being a former rabbi in the Deep South, I served the last large synagogue south of St. Louis, west of Nashville, and east of Denver. So when we talk about the Jewish community in America, if you're talking South Florida, there's 700,000 Jews. If you're talking Manhattan, it's 2 million Jews. If you're talking L.A., it's about 750,000 Jews in Southern California. If you're talking the three states surrounding me where I am right now, you're talking 8,000 to 9,000 Jews in four states. So what keeps me up at night is keeping everyone in the game every child, every adult, so that this heritage goes on, so that it lives. Because I do think Judaism has great ideas for the building of a better world and living a values-based life, having integrity, living ethically, living morally, beyond the spiritual. And I want that to go on. So I try to attract talent here. You know, we occasionally lose it, like at the University of Florida, which you left us for. But Judaism also emphasizes forgiveness. So
yes, I forgive you.
No, I'm still working on that.
That was so eloquently and conveniently thrown in there.
Anyway,
and I really appreciate it.
So I know you've talked a lot about with this sense of passion in helping individuals find their the uniqueness of self to ultimately lead to a global humankind. And I wonder, in thinking about challenging situations, how do you bring courage and conviction to them?
I think you do that through the idea of devotion.
Mm.
And it all depends how you define devotion, right? For me, devotion is passion wedded to love. Fanaticism is passion wedded to fear. And so the older I grow, the more I am into this idea of passion wedded to love. I mean mature love, which... is purely an act of selflessness. It's thinking about the other rather than oneself. So, you know, you and I used to teach high school kids here, and when I teach them the Jewish idea of love, I make a bold statement that I don't think mature teen sex is possible, even if I'm a progressive. And they're like, what do you mean? We can be mature? We're you know, what about... consensual maturity? I said, well, let's go to what Judaism teaches about love. And sex is a manifestation of love, but love, by the devotion definition, is never the result of sex. And love is when you purely care about the other and not about yourself. Not just physically in terms of desire, but in terms of when you look for the love in other people through what you do, whether it's through your service, through your work, it gives you courage that you never know you had, because you realize everyone's a story and everyone has challenges. And if you're feeling sorry for yourself, you have no excuse. You know, it's just like this whole balance thing that we started to talk about. There's an old phrase from Rashi that Ein Shalva Latzadikim Ba'olam Hazeh, which means there's really no balance or no serenity for those who are really striving to do good things in this on this planet. Because when you think about it, when we ask that question, it's really what it's doing to me, how my life is being disrupted by work or stress. And then that's about you. But if you think about your life in terms of always serving others, then you'll never, hopefully, be restful, right? I mean, people tell me they feel close to God when they're in the mountains or at the beach. Of course, there are no people there. You don't have to deal with anyone.
Right? It's a lot easier then, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
So if we're talking about meaning and about courage and about what makes you get up in the morning or keeps you up at night, it's hopefully an act of service and love for others ultimately. Even if you're a business person, you're trying to make a profit, but that's never enough.
No, that's it's powerful. And it leads us, I think you've done a great job of segueing us to what is now the four questions. You are now on the official hot seat. I don't know how warm your seat is right now.
Burning.
The question is, are you ready?
Are you ready?
Yeah.
When you think, and I know you talked about balance and we've kind of discussed that, or integrating, finding an integrated life, what does it mean to you and how do you accomplish it?
I think a balanced life is when your mind, body, and soul are all healthy. And you accomplish that by taking care of all three. Exercise and meditation for the body, stimulating the mind, but also decluttering the mind through restful mindfulness exercises, and reigniting the soul through meaningful work or music, faith, prayer. Mm.
So as we kind of discussed, finding balance can be difficult. And, you know, it's easy when we're not, when we face an easy situation, but when we're faced with the difficulties is when we find where we're at. In thinking about the 11 components, so think about which one of those most resonates with you and why.
I think I would still say health, because to me it encompasses most of the other 11. Hmm. If you love yourself and love others, then you'll take care of yourself physically, since God only gave you one body in this lifetime. I think a healthy mind requires education, constant learning. I think it also involves emotional well-being, certainly rest and eating, which I guess is nosh, and service too. So it's a really tough question you pose, but I would have to go with health because it encompasses virtually all of the others in its expansive definition.
Now, besides running marathons, if you don't know this, Rabbi is quite the marathoner, a Boston marathoner. Did you ever do New York City?
I did not do New York City among the 18 because I was influenced by the Danny DeVito twins poster, where his face is in the armpit of an older European gentleman playing basketball. And I've been told that unless you're a celebrity like Logan or Adam or Oprah, that you are basically that way for the first 3 miles on the Verrazano Bridge, that your face is, and that has scarred my image of the marathon.
So now,
that was extremely vivid and specific.
Yeah, and I appreciate immensely that you've just put us in the same category as Oprah. And
honored.
With that,
honored.
So how do you best embody the characteristic of health in your life?
I'll answer the question, but then I want to give a caveat after, okay? I would say I embody it most by modeling it as best I can. So I have run 18 marathons, which probably isn't a healthy thing to do. So I am running still, but I try to take care of myself physically. I pray as often as possible, and I'm constantly reading and keeping my mind curious. I'm working on a book right now, and that's the way I stay healthy. So the caveat is there's a connotation to how do you embody that, that sounds egocentric, right? It's I am an embodiment of education or health or one of these 11 ideas. I would say humility is a huge part of my life. And when I say humility, I don't mean thinking little of yourself, like some false humility. I think humility is being aware of realities greater than yourself, right? So if you live with a sense of awe and wonder and mystery, then you get filled up with this sense of, I have a new day in this lifetime. What a gift, right? So let me embody one of those 11, but not because I'm great, but because the world is so awesome. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I feel like that you just started the Lego movie. Everything is awesome.
Have you seen this movie? I know I have, four kids, but the title song is Everything is Awesome. So,
wow, the last time I was with you, we saw Frozen together, so I'm glad to hear about another one.
We did. So does that make you Anna or the Snow Queen?
Let's move on.
let's in appropriate context, let it go.
Very nice, Logan.
So last but not least, what's one piece of advice you would offer to those seeking to find greater balance in life?
Well, I thought I answered that earlier.
You probably did, but now this is part of the four questions.
Oh. One piece of advice you would offer what?
You would offer to someone looking for greater balance. See, I'm tricking you here. So if you mess up from your earlier answer, I'm kidding.
I would say listen to your own heart and your internal barometer, as I said before, rather than looking for external answers. Once you embrace the idea that you are a unique signature, and I don't want to get religious because you don't have to believe in God. So we could end the sentence with, you are a unique signature, or you are a unique signature of God, that there never has been and never will be another you. One of the, when you were alongside me here in Memphis, just before you came, we used to teach high school together, Adam, and there was a junior in the junior-senior class whose parents were all ready for him to go to the University of Florida. It was a very tough school to get into, it still is, or to go to Harvard or an Ivy League school. But this guy, great guy, he could fix things. He was not cerebral. He was mechanically inclined, and not in terms of mechanical engineering. He wanted to be a plumber. Now, try telling that to a Jewish parent in the early, late 90s, early 2000s. I want to be a plumber, right? I mean, they had him taking all the pre-SAT, pre-ACT courses, and wanted to bump him up to 1400. He was never going to get, that was when it was a 1600 scale. He was never going to get beyond 1200. And he asked me if I would have a meeting with him and his parents. And so we'll call him Zach. So Zach and I and his two parents are in there. And I asked Zach's father, who I know from being a rabbi here, can you fix anything at home? He's like, what do you mean? I said, well, my wife calls basically the handyman her boyfriend, even though they're not involved beyond, because all I do is change light bulbs. I could barely set up this interview on the computer. So he said, what are you saying? I said, your son can fix anything. And I think plumbers do really well. He said, oh, he told you about it. I said, yeah, that's what this means. And long story short, everyone comes into this world with a unique gift. You just have to discover what it is. Mine wasn't physics. I took physics for poets. Zach's was plumbing. And he went on, has left Memphis, and has a plumbing company and is doing very, very well. So I would say my advice for those seeking greater balance is to listen to what that inner voice says that feeds your soul. What, to go back to your question, what is it that excites you, that enervates you? And if you don't know, it's okay. You'll find it, but don't let other people tell you what that is. That's what I would say.
You are now off the four questions hot seat. However, we do have one more question.
Yes, sir.
If you could recommend, and you talk a lot about reading, a lot about intellectual stimulation. What are five books that you would recommend for people to read?
One is called As a Driven Leaf by Milton Steinberg. It's about the pursuit of knowledge and truth during the rabbinic period. It's a historical novel based on Elisha ben Abuya. He was the heretic who straddled the fence between being a rabbi and living in the larger culture, living in Rome. And he left Orthodoxy back then, you might call it Orthodoxy, before there was Orthodoxy. But he was still bothered by things that he saw in society. So he never stopped being a Jew. That was a transformative book for me way back in my 20s. One that I just read last week, actually last year or in the recent months, is Searching for Stars on an Island in Maine by my teacher, my mentor, my dear friend, Alan Lightman. He wrote Einstein's Dream. But this latest book, Searching for Stars on an Island in Maine, is about essays on religion and science, the awe and wonder of being, you know, the metaphysical, what we know and what we don't know. I'd say another book is Strength to Love, which is a collection of Martin Luther King's sermons and how his religious views motivated his desire for social change. How the spiritual life undergirds social action and the devotion to the struggle for civil and human rights. Everybody quotes King. This book is really interesting because it shows that it was his spiritual life that inspired his civil rights work. Along those lines, I guess I'm to four, Abraham Joshua Heschel and the Sources of Wonder by, everyone talks about Abraham Joshua Heschel. You could read the Sabbath, you could read any of his books, but the one by Michael Marmer, Abraham Heschel and the Sources of Wonder, also shows how it was his spiritual life that got Heschel walking over that bridge in Selma, Alabama, and saying, I felt as though my feet were praying. Or you could read his daughter Susanna Heschel's book called Spiritual Wonder, what's it called? Moral Grandeur and Spiritual Audacity, or Cy Dresner's book on Heschel, anything on Heschel. But those are really good authors on Heschel, Marmer, Heschel's daughter Susanna, and Cy Dresner. And finally, a former professor at the University of Florida, the first or one of the first in religious studies with Warren Bogat, my father's book, actually, called Judaism in Eternal Covenant. He was the greatest teacher and rabbi and scholar of Judaism that I've known, which says a lot because he was an even better dad. But his summary of Judaism through the lens of God, Torah, Israel, encompasses the core ideas, beliefs, histories of this heritage that even the most nominal Jew is a part of. So that book was used. He wrote it after he taught it, while he was at the University of Florida. And it was actually used at Harvard Divinity School as the core text on Judaism. What I love about that book is it's not a rant. In fact, in explaining Judaism in one book, like 150 pages, when you get to the parts on Orthodox Judaism, Conservative Judaism, Reform, Humanistic, Reconstructionist, you can't tell what my dad is when you read the book, because he just explains what they all are. Even though he was a Reform rabbi, you would have never known it. So I guess those are five. Adam, you know my office, so there are a lot on here, so there are a lot more I could go to, but that's enough.
So, first and foremost, thank you very much for sharing. It was really, you breathed some life into us with your inspiration. So thank you very much for taking the time.
So I think I don't speak for just myself when I say that we had a phenomenal conversation with Rabbi Micah Greenstein.
Don't make his head grow any larger than it is.
Love you, Micah. I don't want to cause any undue pain. All right, I'm not here to cause any more stress. That's not what I'm trying to do.
I'm just kidding. Again, one of my dear friends and mentors. He was amazing, wasn't he?
Absolutely. And in going through and re-listening to this episode as I was putting it together, I couldn't help but jot down some notes because I found some really great quotes, some direct, some paraphrase that I think really had a big impact on me. The first one being that that the greatest development in the last 200 years has nothing to do with technology; it's lifespan.
Why is that?
And you know, it's because I'm about to graduate college, and
I can't believe it.
The phrase is, you have your whole life in front of you, and everybody is always asking you, well, what are you going to do? What's next in store? What's next? And sometimes it's hard to look at somebody and say, well, I just don't know.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And you know, in thinking about Rabbi Micah's quote, is that it really helps put it in perspective that if you're about to graduate college and assuming that I'm going to live into my 90s, which I hope I do, that I'm just about to finish my freshman year of life.
It's amazing.
And, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It's like life is short, but life is long.
Yeah, and I think it touches on the idea of what are you going to do with it, right? Is that we're so worried about what the next step is that we forget that our opportunity is not about that moment, but how we move from that moment into each and every moment ahead. It's why I loved one of the quotes I know you brought up, was the idea of serving people.
Oh, yes, yes. So this is fantastic. So Rabbi Greenstein says that if you think about your life in terms of always serving others, then you'll never be restful.
Exactly. And so you think about what you just expressed when it comes to, you know, here you are, you're a graduate, you're in your freshman year, right? I'm 42.
I was born in 19.
No, so 42, I'm not even finished with my sophomore year. And if we think about that perspective.
Underclassman.
I just don't know what I'm going to do. I don't know what I'm going to major in. I'm undecided. No, but
and that's okay.
Thanks. And that's okay. I appreciate that. No, but if we think about that sense of serving people, you're never going to be you're never going to be restful, right? Is that idea that you're constantly thinking about others really is – That's the perspective I think is so important for us to think about, both in the sense of our perspective of lifespan and what we can accomplish and where we're going and that we're always growing. And this aspect of it's not only about us, right? That in that lifespan, if we're serving others, we're never going to be anxious or we're never going to be confused because we always have something to do.
Right.
That and that's amazing.
Right. Well, because I think that when it comes to when you're in college, you are in a bubble.
Yes.
Thanks for agreeing with me on that one, Adam. Appreciate it. No, but when you're in college, you are in a bubble. It's like the type of lifestyle that you have in college, it does not map to realistically to any other timeline in your life. Right. You have. Simultaneously a lot of responsibilities and no responsibilities, and you're usually in most cases only responsible really for yourself, so you're forced with a lot of to confront a lot of these existential questions during this particular time period, but I think that a lot of, and going back to Micah Greenstein's quote, is that a lot of times, you know, we're starting to learn how we develop as individuals, how we connect and relate to other people. And one of the big things that we're told about in college is you got to network, you got to get to know people, right? Because that's where the opportunities are. And that can easily become, are we getting to know, are we networking with these people because we're expecting those opportunities to come and what we can gain from it? Or are we networking with those people because we want to spend time with them, because we enjoy their company, or because we bring them joy by spending our time with them?
Yeah, it's really a profound statement. Is, you know, it's we talk about the networking, and I think it's so much more important to focus on growth. And as the other piece, expectation, we go in with these expectations, and I think that's the toughest thing. I think that's the ego that affects me tremendously is, what are my expectations of this meeting, this conversation, this, you know, and I try to suppress that, and I continue to work on that, and not go in with expectations, right? Mm-hmm. Just let the conversation flow, be there to serve, because we're so locked in to what is this going to do for me that we forget about the we, right? And where I look at it, it's something I try to do quite a bit, is how do you suppress that? It's taken me time over the years. My ego gets in the way. How does this affect me? Mm-hmm. But it's not about network, it's about growth, mm-hmm. right? What's the growth we take from this conversation? What's the opportunity we have to serve and empathize with this individual? And as you just expressed, I think it's such a powerful piece. And I wonder, I know you had another quote about ego in there.
Yes. So and this is because one of our four questions that we always ask every guest is once they tell us what component they relate to the most of our 11-legged stool, if you will, we ask them how do they embody that skill or that component the most? And the first thing that Rabbi Greenstein responds with is that embodiment is egotistic. And I wasn't expecting that, to hear that in response, but it kind of made me question how we're asking the question.
Yeah.
Sort of leading a response. And then it sort of leads into his piece about humility that he brings up immediately following. Humility is not in believing that you're not great at all, but rather being aware of realities greater than yourself.
Yeah, I think that.
And how all those pieces really flow together,
yeah.
Right? Because the reality is that, in going back to our example of networking, that yes, a lot of times who you know does present opportunities, but there is a certain level of genuineness. I'm not 100% sure if that's a real word, but I'm going to go with it. There's a certain level of genuineness that comes from people who are investing time to meet you and vice versa, and you're not expecting that opportunity to come on the back end.
Yeah.
So that when it does come, or if it does ever come, you can be pleasantly surprised because you had no expectation.
No, I take the humility piece in the sense that we are so at times, and I use the collective we, I'll own it as I as well, am at times so worried about the minutiae and how good I am or bad I am at something, that I forget that in the scheme of life, in the scheme of reality, some of that minutia just doesn't matter,
mm-hmm.
right? So humility is understanding that we're a small speck in the universe, right? And how do we serve the deeper things that are important, whether that's our health, the love of family and friends, and without going to our 11-leg stool, how do we focus on that and controlling what we control as opposed to pushing ourselves outside? Humility is realizing what we control and understanding what we don't control.
Exactly. And I think this is a topic that we've touched on in a previous episode, that it's kind of a natural reaction to want to control everything. But really, there are so many things beyond our understanding that happened to us and will continue to happen to us that we, no matter how much force of will we try to exude, we just can't.
Yeah, I think this is where the soulful and what mm-hmm. he was really discussing is so important.
You're talking about how he defines balance.
Yeah, in the sense, and I know, you know, the whole idea of soulful, mind, body, soul, right? Mm-hmm. The triad. And I don't want to be cliche here, but I will. is, okay. Potentially, you'll let me know if I'm cliche, is the, we are so worried about that balance between mind and body, that we lose sight of humility, because it's only soulfulness. And I know we've mentioned this previously about faith, is that faith is understanding or believing in something we cannot see, or trusting in something we cannot see, mm-hmm. right? So it, mind, body, you see it in front of you, right? Your mind's telling you one thing, regardless of whether it's true or not, your mind believes it's true. Your body, right. You look at your body, you feel your body, you know if it's true or not true about your body. Mm-hmm. The thing we can't see, the thing we can't feel, can't touch, that's the soul. And that's the thing, unfortunately, I think most of us, including myself, as much as I think that I am working towards it, is the thing I'm least, and now I'm a rabbi, this is me being vulnerable as a rabbi, is the thing probably I'm least personally and self-aware of to do what needs to be done.
I think that's I think that's really well put. And you know, it's interesting because when you think about the, I guess we'll call it the triangle of mind, body, soul, that for a really long time, that body was the main focus. In today's world, the mind is becoming more into focus. Meditation has exploded in terms of its popularity and people doing mindfulness activities. And soulfulness has kind of always been there, but it is, at least in my perspective, relegated to the, it's relegated to religion and thought of as always being tied to religion. And that's why I think that in a world where not a lot of people consider themselves religious, that they might feel they're lacking in that respect.
So it's so powerful, on multiple levels. I think number one is or at least what I find powerful about that is the irony. Before there was a separation, you had Descartes, or even pre-Descartes, you had the integration of soul, mind, and body. Some of the greatest inventions we know of, mathematics, science, not religiosity or theology, philosophy, is all because those three things were intertwined. Descartes in the 16th century says that and it's interesting you mention this, is the soul is higher than the body. So now the body is the lower, right? So now religion became this thing. And things happen. There's religiosity issues, institutional control, bureaucracy, all those things happen. And now, as you talk about, there's this kind of replacement where the soul has disappeared, the body and mind are kind of potentially equal in the sense of working them out, although people are looking at meditation and all that stuff as mm-hmm. finding their space. And yet, where does that come from? It comes from spirituality, right? It comes from soulfulness. It comes from Buddha. It comes from Judaism. It comes from Christianity. This whole idea of prayer and sacrificing oneself to be whole. But the irony of meditation and working on the mind is they're missing the one important thing. It's exactly what that quote about humility is you can work on your mind and you can talk and you can breathe as much as you want, right? And you can go into your meditative state for silence. But if in any capacity we are not putting ourselves in the position to understand that we are minuscule in the scope of the world and we cannot control what we think we can control, and we should control what we can control and let go and be, that's the essence missing.
I agree. And I think that's a great way to really close this out with this amazing episode with Rabbi Greenstein talking about the true nature of rest. And what does that really mean? And I will leave everybody with one final quote that I think is fantastic to really sum up everything that we talked about. Rabbi Greenstein says, if you're busy, if you're working really hard, if you're feeling empty inside, but you're rocking it academically or professionally, it's your soul that needs feeding. And I hope this episode has opened everybody else's mind, body, and soul to receive some really great wisdom from both Rabbi Adam Grossman and Rabbi Micah Greenstein. And we thank Rabbi Greenstein so much for being on this episode with us.